堂听 class.com。
新英汉口译实践第一和第一单元追求卓越
Unit 1 In Pursuit of Excellence
篇章交传
Passage for Consecutive Interpretation Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese
Welcome to University Awards. I am delighted that we are once again celebrating the achievements of our colleagues together. Our annual University Awards recognize and honor the best in our community. Some have excelled in educating students. Some have scaled new heights in research, while others have served university and country with distinction.Each of our winners has scaled impressive peaks. Your endeavors have made a difference to our university and society. Your achievements help raise the standing of our university. We take pride in your achievements. Is there a formula to achieving excellence? I would like to refer back to the two P's and two C's here.The two P's refer to perspiration and perseverance. The two C's are the quintessential qualities in our quest for excellence, curiosity and courage. Today, I would like to expand on curiosity and courage. Curiosity, or what Einstein called a childlike sense of wonder, makes us question things that others do not even notice.Children are naturally curious. Unfortunately, as they grow up, they often lose their sense of wonder and stop asking questions. But two popular questions remain. What is the right answer? Which is the right answer? How should I answer? The great French novelist Anatole France, Nobel laureate in literature, had this to say.The whole art of teaching is only the art of awakening the natural curiosity of your minds. Einstein added, "It is the supreme art of the teacher to awaken joy in creative expression and knowledge." The educator's role is to draw our students' curiosity, to inspire them, to make them see the world with fresh perspectives.And to lead them to ask different and interesting questions. Curiosity is also a powerful force that drives research. The researcher sustains his joy in knowledge and creative expression and follows a childlike curiosity, leading him to untrodden paths of discovery. As Einstein put it, "I am neither especially clever nor especially gifted,I am only very, very curious." He went on to say, "The important thing is not to stop questioning." Therefore, at the core of the best universities is an intellectual method that encourages questioning. The skepticism towards existing wisdom leads to new ways of thinking and breakthroughs in knowledge.Deepening this spirit of inquiry is the most important challenge for our universities. Courage is resistant to fear, mastery of fear, not absence of fear. When confronting uncertainty in today's rapidly changing world economy, fear is natural. We need courage to deal with uncertainties and fear. Letting go of certainties requires courage.Dealing with uncertainties also requires courage. In a knowledge-based economy, there is no set and tested formula for success. To do well, Our people need to be flexible enough to respond to frequent and discontinuous changes, and be able to create new opportunities for themselves. We have to imbue our students with the ability to innovate, the critical skills to exploit ideas, the confidence to dream big and take risks, and the courage to persevere in adversity. Inspiring students requires courage. You would be leading your students, by your example, along untrodden paths to the cutting edge. At the cutting edge, you often no longer know where the next leap is. By suggesting a way forward, you create a sense of adventure and allow your students to catch a glimpse of the knowledge frontier, inspiring them to press on. This is where teaching and learning become exciting. Indeed, curiosity and courage are quintessential qualities of a scholarly community. They enable us to inspire our students, do pioneering research, and serve with education. Our university's quest for excellence in three areas, research, education, and service, encompasses multiple goals. Many of the desired outcomes are intangible and not readily measured. Increasingly, intellectual breakthroughs do not occur within a single discipline. They tend to occur where there is fertile space for academics from diverse disciplines to explore as well as connect and collaborate with each other. In this way, diversity becomes the strength of a university community. All of us are stakeholders of this university, investing our talents and the best years of our lives. University management does not have a crystal ball for predicting where the next exciting developments will come from. As we scale greater heights, I envisage faculties to be wellsprings of ideas. Correspondingly, I see a need for more bottom-up involvement in developing initiatives and making decisions. There is also a need for greater differentiation to cater for genuine differences among our faculties and disciplines. In doing so, we need to strike an appropriate balance with consistency and equitability. In facing uncertainty and managing change, we need courage to persevere, courage to press on. In a sea change, we can ill afford to remain static. We have a shared responsibility to move forward and ensure a healthy return on our investment. Winners of our university awards exemplify our quest for excellence in education, research, and service. My heartiest congratulations and deepest appreciation go to this year's winners. Let's celebrate the achievements of our colleagues and enjoy your performance. Thank you.
第二单元，快乐真谛。
Unit 2, A Simple Truth About Happiness.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
After I gave a talk on the subject of happiness, a woman in the audience stood up and said, I wish my husband had come. Much as I loved him, she explained, it wasn't easy being married to someone so unhappy. This woman enabled me to put into words what I had been searching for. Altruistic, as well as the personal reasons for taking happiness seriously.I told her that each of us owes it to our spouse, our children, our friends, to be as happy as we can. I was not a particularly happy child, and like most teenagers, I took pleasure in my anguish. One day, however, it occurred to me that I was taking the easy way out. Anyone could be unhappy. It took no courage and effort.True achievement lay in struggling to be happy. The notion that we have to work at happiness comes as news to many people. We assume it's a feeling that comes as a result of good things that just happen to us, things over which we have little or no control. But the opposite is true. Happiness is largely under our control. It is a battle to be fought and not a feeling to be awaited. To achieve a happy life, it's necessary to overcome some stumbling blocks, three of which are 1. Comparison with others. Most of us compare ourselves with anyone we think happier, a relative, an acquaintance, or often someone we barely know. I once met a young man who struck me as particularly successful and happy. He spoke of his love for his beautiful wife and their 3 daughters, and of his joy at being a radio talk show host in a city he loved. I remember thinking that he was one of those lucky few for whom everything goes effortlessly right. Then we started talking about the Internet. He blessed its existence, he told me, because he could look up information on multiple sclerosis, the terrible disease afflicting his wife. I felt like a fool for assuming nothing unhappy existed in his life. 2. Images of perfection. Almost all of us have images of how life should be. The problem, of course, is that only rarely do people's jobs, spouses, and children live up to these imagined ideals. Here's a personal example. No one in my family had ever divorced. I assumed that marriage was for life. So, when my wife and I divorced after 5 years of marriage and 3 years after the birth of our son, my world collapsed. I was a failure in my own eyes. I later remarried and confided to my wife that I couldn't shake the feeling that my family life had failed. She asked me what was wrong with our family now, which included her daughter from a previous marriage and my son. I had to admit that, aside from the pain of being with my son only half the time, my ex-wife and I shared custody, our family life was wonderful. Then why don't you celebrate it? She asked. That's what I decided to do. But first I had to get rid of a perfect family. 3. Missing tile syndrome. One effective way of destroying happiness is to look at something and focus on even the smallest flaw. It's like looking at the tiled ceiling and concentrating on the space where one tile is missing. As a bald man told me, whenever I enter a room, all I see is hair. Once you've determined what your missing tile is, explore whether acquiring it will really make you happy. Then do one of the 3 things. Get it, replace it with a different tile, or forget about it, and focus on the tiles in your life that are not missing. We all know people who have had a relatively easy life, yet are essentially unhappy. And we know people who have suffered a great deal, but generally remain happy. The first secret is gratitude. All happy people are grateful. Ungrateful people cannot be happy. We tend to think that being unhappy leads people to complain, but it's truer to say that complaining leads to people becoming unhappy. The second secret is realizing that happiness is a byproduct of something else. The most obvious sources of those pursuits that give our lives purpose, anything from studying insects to playing baseball, the more passions we have, the more happiness we are likely to experience. Finally, the belief that something permanent transcends us and that our existence has some larger meaning can help us be happier. We need a spiritual faith or a philosophy of life. Whatever your philosophy, it should include this truism: If you choose to find the positive in virtually every situation, you will be blessed. And if you choose to find the awful, you will be cursed. As with happiness itself, this is largely your decision to make.
第三单元，家庭婚姻。
Unit 3, Family and Marriage.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
I'm a research psychologist, and I've been doing researches on the problems of marriage and family. Today I feel greatly honored to be invited to give a talk on this subject. Being a good parent is harder now than it has ever been before.In pressurized modern lives, demands to be a fulfilled individual and a good partner and a good worker take no account of being a good parent. We haven't left space for the nurturing parents to care for their children and provide the kind of care that their children need. As a result, many families in the Western world just don't work.I think most of us have a bit of a yearning for a table full of children descending neatly in size, the older ones helping the younger ones. Let's control our nostalgia. That traditional family had many faults, not least in the roles it imposed on females. The problem is that in the last generation or so, we've come to assume that women should be able and want to do everything that both men and women have done by tradition. And it's just not possible. Indeed, since adopting a male agenda in life is probably only another form of the traditional ethics that men are superior to women, quite a number of highly educated and economically privileged women are now opting to take career breaks so as to be at home with their children for longer than the 18 weeks. Having children, especially the first child, puts a bigger strain on a couple's relationship than anything else they ever do. Some who stay together emerge stronger and richer, but numerous couples never recover. So a future of smaller families and more people choosing not to have children at all could well leave couples closer than they are today. For many, the purpose of being together would be solely to pleasure and support each other, an interesting prospect. Let's hope people in the future will only have children if they really want them. And that should mean something that is seen as a much more positive commitment than it is now, and that parents are socially supported and admired for doing a good job.The whole point of marriage is that it imposes clear obligations, not just the right to pursue your own happiness. And the main obligation is to provide both emotional and practical nurture for children. Children demand sacrifice and altruism, a long-term investment of parental time and money. Of course, the highest reward that parents expect is to see their children develop and become useful talents for the society.
第四单元，乐观人生。
Unit 4, Be optimistic about life.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
If you expect something to turn out badly, it probably will. Pessimism is seldom disappointed. But the same principle also works in reverse. If you expect good things to happen, they usually do. There seems to be a natural cause and effect relationship between optimism and success. Optimism and pessimism are both powerful forces, and each of us must choose which we want to shape our outlook and our expectations. There is enough good and bad in everyone's life, ample sorrow and happiness, sufficient joy and pain, to find a rational basis for either optimism or pessimism. We can choose to laugh or cry, bless or curse. It's our decision. From which perspective do we want to view life? Will we look up in hope or down in despair? I believe in the upward look. I choose to highlight the positive and slip fight over the negative. I am an optimist by choice as much as by nature. Sure, I know that sorrow exists. I am in my 70s now, and I've lived through more than one crisis. But when all is said and done, I find that the good in life far outweighs the bad. An optimistic attitude is not a luxury, it's a necessity. The way you look at life will determine how you feel, how you perform, and how well you will get along with other people. Conversely, negative thoughts, attitudes, and expectations feed on themselves. They become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Pessimism creates a dismal place where no one wants to live. The only thing more powerful than negativism is a positive affirmation, a word of optimism and hope. One of the things I am most thankful for is the fact that I have grown up in a nation with a grand tradition of optimism. When a whole culture adopts an upward look, incredible things can be accomplished. When the world is seen as a hopeful, positive place, people are empowered to attempt and to achieve. Optimism doesn't need to be naive. You can be an optimist and still recognize that problems exist and that some of them are not dealt with easily. But what a difference optimism makes in the attitude of the problem solver. For example, through the years, I've heard some people say that the money spent on our space program has been wasted. Instead of spending $455 million to put a man on the moon, they say, why not spend that money here on Earth on the poverty problem? But when you ask them exactly how they would spend that money to solve the poverty problem, most of them don't have an answer. Give me a solution, I tell them, and I'll raise you the money. Think in positive terms about how to address the issue rather than criticizing money spent on another program, such as America's Space Program, which resulted in many positive discoveries that have benefited humanity. Optimism diverts our attention away from negativism and channels it into positive, constructive thinking. When you're an optimist, you're more concerned with problem-solving than with useless carping about issues. In fact, without optimism, issues as big and ongoing as poverty have no hope of solution. It takes a dreamer, someone with hopelessly optimistic ideas, great persistence, and unlimited confidence to tackle a problem that is big. It's your choice.
第五单元，老龄问题。
Unit 5 Old Age Problems
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
I have noticed the tone of pride and satisfaction with which middle-aged children in America announce that their 80 or 90-year-old mother still lives in her own house, as if voluntary isolation were the pinnacle of geriatric heroism. In the last 20 years, the number of Americans over 65 who live with their adult children declined by half, dropping from 18% to 9%. There are doubtlessly many reasons for this decrease, from the improved health of older Americans to the number of two or more job households. Nevertheless, a third of the over 65 population live entirely alone. One might expect the older that people get, and thus the more help they need, the more likely they are to live with one of their children. Just the reverse is true. If you make it to 85, the odds of your living alone jump to 1 in 2. Do the old people in the United States like to live alone? No doubt some of them do, or at least some of them prefer living alone to the changes and compromises that living with others entails. Independence is, after all, the chief and most honored virtue in this country. The ideal, ingrained in us early, persists even when we can, quite literally, no longer stand on our own 2 feet. When our aging parents' need for help grows too obvious to ignore, we say they are beginning to fail. Losing one's independence is, for Americans, a shameful thing. Independence, autonomy, isolation. On this unstable trinity, the lives of older Americans are precariously balanced. But if you live long enough, independence inevitably becomes an illusion. Slowly the edges of your sovereign island start to erode. You can no longer keep up with the yard work, so you move to a condominium or even a retirement center. You can't see well enough to drive anymore. You call the pharmacy, and a computerized voice gives so many instructions about pushing phone buttons, you hang up in despair. Seeking help with these mundane chores of living means surrendering control as well. If you ask others to take you to the grocery store, you must fit your shopping to their schedule and preference for supermarkets. Rely on Meals on Wheels to deliver your dinner, and you have to accept unfamiliar dishes. If your daughter volunteers to clean your house, you can't point out to her, the way you could when she was a teenager, the dust she missed. After a lifetime of doing and having things your own way, you may have to work at feeling, or even faking, gratitude.
第6单元, 约定终身.
Unit 6. From Dating to Wedding.
篇章交传.
Passage for Consecutive Interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
I do. To Americans, those two words carry great meaning. They can even change your life, especially if you say them at your own wedding. Making wedding vows is like signing a contract. Now, Americans don't really think marriage is a business deal. But marriage is a serious business. It all begins with engagement. Traditionally, a young man asks the father of his sweetheart for permission to marry her. If the father agrees, the man later proposes to her. Often he tries to surprise her by popping the question in a romantic way. Sometimes the couple just decides together that the time is right to get married. The man usually gives his fiancée a diamond ring as a symbol of their engagement. They may be engaged for weeks, months, or even years. As the big day approaches, bridal showers and bachelor's parties provide many useful gifts. Today, many couples also receive counseling during engagement. This prepares them for the challenges of married life. At last it's time for the wedding. Although most weddings follow long-held traditions, there's still room for American individualism. For example, the usual place for a wedding is in a church, but some people get married outdoors in a scenic spot. A few even have the ceremony while skydiving or riding on horseback. The couple may invite hundreds of people or just a few close friends. They choose their own style of colors, decorations, and music during the ceremony. But some things rarely change. The bride usually wears a beautiful long white wedding dress. She traditionally wears something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue. The groom wears a formal suit or tuxedo. Several close friends participate in the ceremony as attendants, including the best man and the maid of honor. As the ceremony begins, the groom and his attendants stand with the minister facing the audience. Music signals the entrance of the bride's attendants, followed by the beautiful bride. Nervously, the young couple repeats their vows. Traditionally, they promise to love each other for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. But sometimes, the couple has composed their own vows. They give each other a gold ring to symbolize their marriage commitment. Finally, the minister announces the big moment, "I now pronounce you man and wife. You may kiss the bride." At the wedding reception, the bride and groom greet their guests. Then they cut the wedding cake and feed each other a bite. Guests mingle while enjoying cake, punch, and other treats. Later, the bride throws her bouquet of flowers to a group of single girls. Tradition says that the one who catches the bouquet will be the next to marry. During the reception, playful friends decorate the couple's car with tissue paper, tin cans, and a just married sign. When the reception is over, the newlyweds run to their decorated car and speed off. Many couples take a honeymoon, a 1 to 2 week vacation trip to celebrate their new marriage. Almost every culture has rituals to signal a change in one's life. Marriage is one of the most basic life changes for people of all cultures. So it's no surprise to find many traditions about getting married, even in America. Yet each couple follows the traditions in a way that is uniquely their own. ¶¶